from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, the National Transportation Safety Board issued a number of safety recommendations on Monday related to pipeline operating pressures in the wake of the lethal blast in San Bruno. We'll hear what's in those recommendations, a majority of them marked urgent, as we talk with the chairwoman of the NTSB, as well as the Director of Consumer Protection and Safety of the California Public Utilities Commission and the Vice President of Gas Engineering and Operations for PG&E. And we'll take your calls, emails, and online comments. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. The National Transportation Safety Board issued seven recommendations on Monday, six of them urgent, related to the regulation of pipeline pressure limits in the wake of the pipeline disaster in San Bruno that killed eight people and damaged 53 homes, 38 of which were destroyed. An NTSB hearing is slated for March 1st and 2nd in Washington, D.C. to discuss the facts surrounding the nearly hour-and-a-half gas-fueled conflagration, and a final report on the causes of the blast is not expected until next year. Meanwhile, the NTSB recommended, among other things, that Pacific Gas and Electric urgently review its records to reassess maximum allowable pipeline pressures based on identified weak points. In a letter issued on Monday, the California Public Utilities Commission, which regulates pipeline operations, ordered PG&E to search for records related to pipe segments, valves, fittings, and used seams to set maximum operating pressures based on the weakest sections of pipelines. The PUC gave PG&E until February 1st to comply, and in this morning's opening forum hour, we focus our attention on these recent events and discuss what they mean, well, for Northern California and beyond. Joining us first is Kirk Johnson. He's Vice President of Gas Engineering and Operations with Pacific Gas and Electric, and we welcome you to the program. Kirk Johnson, good morning.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. I appreciate the time.
Glad to have you here, and I guess let's begin by talking about the fact that you've said publicly that you're giving these recommendations very close and immediate attention, which is certainly reassuring for the public to hear. However, I wanted to get into the fact that in these recommendations, the investigation said that there was a seam that wasn't welded properly, that may not have been responsible for the explosion, but that wasn't a part of the records. And so let's get to that right away. What are you doing to verify, first of all, the fact that you seem to be at odds with the National Transportation Safety Board on this? I think, in fact, you had said publicly that the seams along the ruptured pipeline were not that important.
Well, Michael, in terms of, I don't believe we're at odds at all with the NTSB, and in fact, we continue to support them on the investigation. I think what's absolutely critical for all the parties, including PG&E and the state of California and the entire pipeline community, is that we ultimately find out and determine what caused this incident in San Bruno. That's absolutely critical for us so we can ensure that the pipeline integrity of our entire grid, the gas transportation grid, is that we can check for this. So I think ultimately we are all have the exact same goal, which is to find out what caused the issue in San Bruno. In terms of statements that were made around seamed or seamless pipe, this is information around what was shared with the NTSB the evening of the event. And as we all know, that the pipeline segments per the NTSB investigation have shown that there were indeed seams in the pipe. In terms of the activity, the maintenance activity that PG&E conducts on its pipeline, such as maintenance patrols, leak surveys, operating and maintaining our valves and other pieces of equipment on the pipeline, in terms of whether a pipeline has a seam or doesn't have a seam, that doesn't drive any of that activity. We conduct that business the same, irregardless of whether there's a seam or not a seam on the pipeline. Having said that, we do take this very seriously, and immediately after seeing this activity and understanding that we did have a discrepancy between our records and actually what was in the ground at that specific location, we did start an investigation, and we are continuing with an investigation of what has been deemed an evaluation study or a maximum allowable operating pressure validation study, and we continue that work on the San Francisco Peninsula and we will continue that work on the rest of our gas transmission system going forward.
But you do have, according to the reports, flawed records, and there is certainly a great deal of public concern about the fact that you have flawed records. What's being done on that score?
Well, and I understand that public concern, and that's exactly what I was referring to, is we are going back through as part of our validation studies, and we will be pulling the original source documents. And let me take a moment for your listeners. In terms of the records that PG&E has on its pipelines, and these are pipelines that many were built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, well before the age of computers, those records are all paper documents. And so what we are doing is going into the records where those pipelines were built throughout our entire service territory and pulling all the paper documents in and essentially starting from scratch, reviewing all those paper documents and ensuring that they match up with our summary level documents that we use for informational purposes. And so that's the activity that we're taking in San Francisco Peninsula, and that's the activity that we'll take going forward to ensure that our records are as accurate as possible.
And what are you doing to verify the operating pressure of your pipelines?
Well, in terms of operating pressure, that activity is ongoing, and that is part of our requirement in terms of maintaining and operating our pipelines. Specific to the order that the NTSB, explicit to the recommendation the NTSB made and the order that the California Public Utilities Commission gave us earlier this week, we will, as part of that activity, be conducting a maximum allowable operating pressure review, and that is we look at all the records, we look at all the conditions of our pipeline, and then we go back and review and ensure that that pipeline, that maximum allowable operating pressure for that pipeline, is accurate for the conditions of that, each and every segment of that pipeline.
And what about inspections that you may be planning simply to perform, and on how many miles of pipeline?
Well, in terms of the miles of pipeline impacted by this order, and the order was very clear, it is to cover specific types of pipelines. Many will refer to these as high-consequence area pipelines, and a high-consequence area has a very clear definition in the code, and it's based on how many residents or how many types of buildings are within a certain diameter or a certain radius of that pipeline segment. In terms of the amount of miles of pipe that we will be looking at, it's approximately, per this recommendation, it's approximately 1,800 miles of pipeline that we will be reviewing as part of the request by both the NTSB and the California Public Utilities Commission.
Kirk Johnson with us, Vice President of Gas Engineering and Operations for PG&E. The pipelines certainly had a seam, and at first, as we've indicated, you thought it didn't have one. Can you give us some assurance here that the pipelines we're walking over really every day are the pipelines that you think are under there?
Absolutely. I want to reinforce that everything we do in our pipeline is to ensure the safety and the integrity of the pipeline system. And we continue to do all the maintenance, all the inspections, and everything possible to ensure that safety. And in fact, the men and women of PG&E are absolutely committed to that as their top priority of operating a safe and reliable gas transmission system. In terms of the review, that's something we're going to go through and ensure that those documents that we utilize and that are used for informational purposes are accurate compared to the original diagrams and drawings that we have in our files. I do want to expand on that just a little bit, Michael, and state that when we do a construction job or something significant, including digging up the pipe or any maintenance that requires us to dig up the pipe, we actually reference back to the original document. So, and we will actually dig up the pipeline and verify its condition before any activity takes place. So all those verifications on the pipe are done prior to any work going forward.
Kirk Johnson, appreciate very much your being with us this morning.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Kirk Johnson, again, is Vice President of Gas Engineering and Operations for Pacific Gas and Electric. Deborah Herzman is the chair of the National Transportation Safety Board, and she joins us this morning as well from Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program. Glad to have you.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. I just wanted to get it on the record here. We still don't know the cause of the blast. It hasn't been made public, but that 54-year-old natural gas pipeline that exploded on September 9th under San Bruno, according to your report, had a welded seam from both the outside and the inside, and that was not in the documents.
Well, that's right. We know that this section of pipe that was involved in the ruptured area was not a seamless pipe, and it had both circumferential and longitudinal welds in the vicinity of where the rupture took place. And so I think certainly that was something that we want to closely examine. We want to identify where the pipe was manufactured, if it was factory or field manufactured, and also understanding what kind of risks might have existed.
That's analogous to a chain only being literally as strong as its weakest link, isn't it?
It is. You absolutely have to know what type of infrastructure you have on your system in order to do an appropriate risk assessment. And so if you are not accurately assessing what type of pipe you have in those locations for that pipe and where risk might exist, you're going to have a difficult time doing an accurate assessment, and that includes establishing maximum operating pressure. You've got to know what your inventory is.
And is it true that we still don't know the manufacturer of those pieces of pipe?
Well, we have some information from PG&E that they provided us early on in the investigation, but we are not confident that that information is accurate, and that's, in fact, why we've asked them to do an extensive and exhaustive record search, not just of their records, but potentially other records that may be held by former employees, city, state, other records that might exist. And fortunately, in many of our investigations, we see older equipment or infrastructure. We investigated the Minneapolis bridge collapse several years ago, and we ended up being able to find original drawings and calculations for the bridge design, but they were actually in a former engineer's garage who had retired.
Well, there was a good deal of concern, and again, the word urgent kept coming up, about the record-keeping problems of PG&E. You recommended an intensive record search. What does that mean exactly?
Well, I think in particular we're concerned about the section of the pipeline that ruptured and that failed to identify that pipeline. Because, for example, if it was a factory-manufactured pipeline and there were some areas of weakness there, we would want to make sure anyone else who had that pipeline and had potentially installed that on their line would know that they may need to inspect it or take a look at it if we thought that there was some factory defect that might be identified. But if it's something that was manufactured in the field, I think we'd want to make sure that we understood how many events like that occurred throughout the system. Were there other places where there were things that were manufactured in the field or done spot welding while they were out on site? Not only should they know what they have in the ground, but there also should have been a process to inspect that pipe once it was laid. And so we're looking for any records that exist so we can conduct a very thorough and detailed investigation to learn from this accident so that we can prevent other accidents from occurring.
Deborah Herzman, again, chairs the National Transportation Safety Board. The other thing that came out in your report is concern with other pipeline operations really throughout the United States.
That's true. And, you know, we issued some recommendations specifically to PG&E because they were obviously involved in this accident in San Bruno. But what we identified gave us pause because we were concerned that maybe other pipelines in California or maybe other pipelines throughout the country might have similar erroneous information or inadequate information about their infrastructure. And so we made recommendations to the CPUC as well as PHMSA, the federal regulator, to get information out about the circumstances of this accident to other pipeline operators.
Well, Congresswoman Jackie Speier is going to introduce a bill requiring utilities to install automatic shutoff valves on pipelines in populated areas like San Bruno and conduct more rigorous inspections of pipelines. I presume that this is something that you welcome.
Well, the Safety Board has for many years looked at the issue of inspections. And we want to make sure that the inspections are targeted in the right areas and that the risk assessments are proper. But the other thing that her legislation would focus on is automatic shutoff valves. And we've seen some great success with respect to development of technology and the equipment that's available over a number of years with respect to automatic shutoff valves, excess flow valves, and other safety devices. And so I think one of the things we will be looking at in this investigation is why it took so long to actually shut down the pipeline and looking at those manual valves and how employees or others got to those valves to shut them down, how difficult or how easy that was.
Well, getting back, if we may, for a moment to PG&E specifically, they have said that the record-keeping discrepancy really never had any impact on the required maintenance and inspection protocols. Is that true?
Well, I think that that's something that CPUC and PG&E are going to have to take a look at with respect to the inspection protocols. The Safety Board is very interested in understanding what requirements were in existence in the 50s when this pipe was laid in the ground, and what type of inspections and maintenance activities have taken place over the intervening 50-plus years, and if those had been adequate.
Just one other question, if I may, Deborah Herzman. PG&E also lobbied federal regulators successfully to avoid expensive pipeline tests, which can involve a good deal of shutting down pipelines and pumping water through them. Can you comment on that?
The Safety Board did issue a recommendation to PG&E this week recommending that they actually conduct hydrostatic testing to determine the appropriate maximum operating pressure for their line. And really, this is the equivalent of emptying the line of the gas, pumping it full of water, overpressurizing it to help really to identify and grow any cracks or failures that might exist before they would take place in service and when they have gas in the line. And so those could be identified and corrected and repaired. It is something that we have recommended. We recognize that there's also some challenges this time of year with shutting down a gas line. And we also recommend that they're operating at a reduced pressure now on the guidance of CPUC. And so we'll certainly continue to monitor that. But we had concerns given their lack of accurate records that determining the maximum operating pressure is something that is really predicated on understanding what you have on your system and what the maximum operating pressure should be, and that a direct way to assess that is actually to conduct this hydrostatic test. We only can recommend things. We don't require them, and so it really is up to other people to decide whether or not they want to implement our recommendations.
Well, we'll follow up on that in just a moment, but I want to extend my thanks to you for joining us this morning. Deborah Herzman, again, chairs the National Transportation Safety Board, and you're going to be having a hearing in March, as I said earlier, right?
We are. We're going to have a two-day investigative hearing in March, and it will be webcast, so and also archived on our website so people can watch all of those proceedings.
Again, we thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Have a good day.
You too. And Richard Clark is here with us, Cecilia, Director of Consumer Protection and Safety for the California Public Utilities Commission. Good morning, Richard Clark.
Good morning, Michael.
And what we're seeing is the PUC is going to direct PG&E to follow these recommendations?
We've already done so, yes.
The letter was issued, in fact, on Monday.
Yes.
I believe.
Actually, we'd been looking into this issue of hydrostatic testing since early December, when we issued a data request to PG&E to give us all the records on all their hydrostatic testing on all their lines. And we received that data, and we're going through it.
Well, let me go into some of the specifics here with you, if I could, Richard. The first of all, PG&E had more pipeline infractions than the rest of the state's major pipelines combined over a six-year period. That's according to the San Francisco Chronicle, which has reported that the CPUC didn't levy a single fine during that period on the utility. And can you clear that up for us?
Certainly, I'd be happy to. The first issue is that the reason that PG&E's statistics that the Federal Pipeline Hazardous Management Safety Administration keeps and we keep, the reason the number of violations are higher with PG&E is because they self-report. We have them go out and do an audit of themselves before we go out and do the audit, and then we look over their shoulder and make sure they found what they were supposed to find and did what they were supposed to do. So their numbers are higher than Southern California Gas and San Diego Gas and Electric because of that fact. SoCal Gas and SDG&E have not gotten to the point yet in where they're self-reporting the violations that they find themselves.
Self-reporting, that is a major reason for the difference.
Yes, with nine people for the state of California up until recently, we now have 13. It's very difficult for us to go out and find everything. by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, after the event in San Bruno, I think you were quoted as saying this is an anomalous event. But there was back in February 2009 a letter from one of your inspectors, Sunil Shori, I believe is how you pronounce her name, which found found serious safety issues with the company's gas distribution system.
Again, that's with the distribution system, and when I was talking about anomalous events, I was talking about in the transmission system, which is very different than the distribution system.
This distribution system is, however, different than the high-pressure transmission lines involved in the San Bruno incident.
Yes, very different.
Yeah. But the letter obtained by the San Francisco Chronicle quoted, and I'm stating, it is apparent to us that the failure of PG&E to provide adequate procedures or the failure of PG&E personnel to follow established procedures has resulted in safety risks that would most likely not have been created. This seems consistent with some of the problems that were identified by the NTSB. Why wasn't it treated with more urgency?
Well, it was treated with great urgency. I mean, Sunil Shori and the team that he works with have been all over this issue since then, trying to identify a piece of pipe that's in the ground that's been there for, you know, since 1956 at least. You know, it's very difficult to identify that particular piece of pipe. And again, we don't know what the actual issue was with the failure of the pipeline in San Bruno yet.
And we're talking with Richard Clark, who is Director of Consumer Protection and Safety for the California PUC, the Public Utilities Commission. The Chronicle also reported back in November that mile for mile, California's regulators devote the least time to pipeline inspections of any state, and that federal officials have withheld a portion of funding for inspections for 7 years in a row because the state has not met enforcement targets. And is that true? And if so, why did the state not meet enforcement requirements or targets?
Well, there have been a number of things that have happened in the intervening years between, but the fact of the matter is that we need more inspectors out there doing what it is that they need to do. We have utilized all the inspectors that we have as diligently as we possibly can. These people work incredibly hard. You can see from Mr. Shorey's inspection records, the results of his inspections, that they're very, very diligent people.
So are you fairly sanguine about the future here?
Sanguine about the
positive
future?
Optimistic? Yeah.
Yes, I think that we now have the momentum going forward that frequently occurs in these sorts of situations. We have the NTSB making very good recommendations for us going forward and for PG&E going forward. We're getting the people that we need to do the work, and we're out there doing the work every day.
Well, I'm going to open the phone lines and invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation. We're also going to hear from John Upton when we return, who's been covering this for the Bay Citizen and is a reporter with them. And we'd like to hear from you if you have some thoughts about, the new National Transportation Safety Board urgent recommendations. And we're looking back, of course, at the disaster of what happened in San Bruno and how it can be avoided in the future. And the real question maybe to you, the listeners, is how safe do you feel and how concerned are you about ongoing pipeline safety? Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. And since we are heard nationally, I should mention, as I did before to Deborah Herzman from the National Transportation Safety Board, that this is a national issue, of course, and does concern people everywhere in particularly populated areas. Our email address, if you'd like to email us, forum@kqed.org. You can join us that way with any questions or comments, or you can post a question or comment on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. We spoke with Kirk Johnson, Vice President of Gas Engineering and Operations with PG&E, with Deborah Herzman, Chair of the National Transportation Safety Board, Richard Clark with us, Director of Consumer Protection and Safety for the California PUC, and when we return, John Upton, reporter for the Bay Citizen, and your calls and emails. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The National Transportation Safety Board released urgent recommendations to Pacific Gas and Electric on Monday regarding pipeline safety in the wake of the San Bruno explosion, which killed 8 people. We spoke earlier with NTSB Chair Deborah Herzman about the recommendations, and we checked in with the PG&E Vice President of Gas Engineering and Operations, Kirk Johnson, and with us is Richard Clark from the PUC, the Director of Consumer Protection and Safety for the California Public Utilities Commission. We also invite you to join us if you have questions or comments, or if you certainly want to reflect upon just the whole question of safety and the concern that we have about what these recommendations involve, which have to do, of course, not only with record keeping, but with the pipeline that exploded under San Bruno, having a welded seam from both the outside and the inside. That was not in the documents originally. And in fact, originally there was pretty much, agreement from PG&E, at least, that the pipeline, which is about 54 years old, was seamless. We welcome your phone calls. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or your emails. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. You can also join us on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. I'm going to bring John Upton into the conversation. First, I want to go back, if I may, Richard Clark, to you, and just get your response to something that Congresswoman Jackie Speier said about regulation failure here. And she singled out the PUC as well as PG&E and said you're both culpable and have lost credibility. Does that feel right to you?
Oh, I think we've definitely sustained a hit on our credibility, that's for sure, and we're working as hard as we can to rebuild that credibility. But I see this as a system failure. This is a system failure that involves the Federal Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration, as well as the CPUC, as well as the PG&E, the legislature. I mean, this is an entire system. And what the NTSB is really doing here, I think, in terms of its recommendations, is it's targeting pipe that was installed before 1970, when hydrostatic testing was required of all the pipeline segments that are installed after 1970, and portions of the system that were installed before 1970 were grandfathered in if they'd been stable for 5 years. The maximum allowable operating pressure is set upon that 5 years. So these were decisions that were made some 40 years ago.
Let me bring John Upton, who's here with us in studio, who's a reporter from the Bay Citizen, who's been following this all, since the explosion occurred and even before. System failure. Does that sound right to you, John?
Absolutely sounds correct to me. The safety-related work that's going to be mandated for PG&E in the coming years and decades because of this tragedy, the record searches, the hydrostatic testing, it should have been occurring in recent decades. It hasn't been occurring because of basically cost-cutting measures, I believe, which has helped to keep our energy costs down, so we've benefited from that. It's also had the effect of, maintaining prices for natural gas at a very competitive level. What we're going to see now, as a result of all of these years and decades of basically system failure, which has culminated in this disaster and in others, is a spurt of safety-related work that's going to end up costing ratepayers a lot of money. It's going to see either rates go up, and if the rates don't go up, then the work won't get done. So that's going to be the end consequence.
The rates are almost inevitably going to go up, one can assume.
They absolutely have to, because the way that the system works, the ratepayers pay for safety-related work. If you're buying gas, then you're also funding maintenance of those gas pipelines. And if there's no maintenance going into those gas pipelines, then the gas is cheaper than it would be if they were maintained properly.
Well, some of these pipelines, as we've heard, are so old. I mean, the costs and just the nature of how formidable the task is of really seeing to the maintenance of these pipelines is pretty, a big mountain to climb.
Absolutely. And the decades of system failure have resulted in a deteriorated system that now we look at it and what do? It's going to take a lot of work.
I got an email here from a listener who says, PG&E workmen who were back for a fourth time in an effort to reinstall a gas line on a lot told me the problem was that the records for where the lines were had been lost in a PG&E computer that crashed. This is Oakland on the Hayward Fault, so I wondered if PG&E could turn off gas to broken lines if we had an earthquake. I'm just now hearing on your program that PG&E self-reports, but I've never heard about the loss of information about where the pipelines are from any other source. Question, who is keeping this information from the public to keep us from fear or possible economic fallout or from lack of regulatory and inspection staff? Answer to your question, I feel less safe about this than my life being taken by another attack such as we had on 9/11. Richard Clark.
Well, these systems, again, we're talking about the transmission system of the natural gas system across the nation. It's been a very safe system. It's been a very efficient system for getting natural gas to our homes, to our businesses, to our hospitals, to our schools, all everything we do, lots of things that we do, it's based upon natural gas. It's much safer than hauling it around the country by truck. So I don't think that people should take an event that has occurred in San Bruno and blow it out of proportion. Again, these are not frequent events that occur, and we don't know what happened in San Bruno yet precisely, but we're sure spending a lot of time looking and trying to figure it out.
Well, you're certainly also showing greater concern about pipeline operations and following, making certain, presumably, that the utility is going to follow pipeline rules as well as these recommendations.
Absolutely.
Let me go to our callers, and we'll begin, Vince, with you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. PG&E clearly monitors how much gas comes out of the pipe from each homeowner. Do they not know how much gas goes into the pipe and therefore know the difference in how much is leaking and how much is leaking throughout the state?
Yeah, how vigilant can they be on that score? John Upton, you want to take that?
Well, I think they do know how much gas is going into the pipelines. The questions that's been raised by the NTSB report relate to how much pressure the pipelines can actually handle. So there's no, I don't think there's serious questions about how much gas is being moved around the system. I think it's a question about whether the system can handle that much gas.
That's pretty much the case, is it, Richard Clark?
That's correct.
Yeah. Let me thank the caller and move on to Henry, who's joining us from San Francisco. Henry, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
To reiterate here, Mr. Clark said a minute ago about blowing things out of proportion. I thought it was sort of a Freudian slip. But this is a perfect example of how there's systemic failure in the large corporations in this country, and the bottom line comes in first, and nothing is done until somebody gets killed. So this is really unfortunate, and, you know, perhaps one of your guests can address that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. John Upton, how much does this have to do with bottom-line profit or, I mean, from your assessment? Big corporation, too big to fail, whatever.
Well, the interesting thing about PG&E is that it's a monopoly. And not only that it's a monopoly, but it's a heavily regulated monopoly. And they are guaranteed a profit. It's a fairly substantial profit. I think it's more than 11%. And it's in their best interest to keep prices down, and it's in their interest to keep prices down by cutting costs where they can, and it's in their interest to cut costs by saving on maintenance work, on records keeping. So they go to the CPUC and they tell them their safety inspection plans, and it's up to the CPUC as the regulators really to keep a close eye on this corporate monopoly.
And as I said earlier, the federal regulators were successfully lobbied by PG&E to avoid those expensive tests that can involve shutting pipelines down and pumping all that water through them. This is simply done to save money, obviously.
That is absolutely a cost-saving measure, 100%, yes.
You want to comment on that, Richard Clark?
Well, I don't think you could call it a cost-saving measure 100%. I mean, the law does require that the maximum allowable operating pressure not be set any higher than the highest pressure that's sustained in a five-year period prior to 1970 if it's not hydrostatic testing. And everything after 1970, installed after 1970, has had hydrostatic testing. So it's not just a matter of economics. But economics is important. It's absolutely important. People have to be able to afford the natural gas that they get. And this is actually very similar to what happened in Chatsworth when we had the train collision down there and 25 people died because a locomotive engineer was texting. And it took that tragedy in order to move forward an NTSB recommendation that people in the railroad safety industry have been advocating for years and years and years of positive train control. Huge cost, but it's being done, and it's being done well and expeditiously.
You know, you use the Chatsworth analogy, it brings to mind the fact that, unfortunately, so often these kind of tragedies happen in order to have the reactivity that we're seeing now, as opposed to being proactive or following what people are suggesting prophylactically a long time ago.
That's true. However, I think it's important to remember and to realize that there are people who work on these issues every day, and this is a continually improving process. And so you know, people are looking at what the core issues are, identifying the core issues and that sort of thing. And that sort of work is what it is that helps the NTSB come to, you know, kind of laser-guided recommendations here that help us target and help us move forward in the safety business here in the state of California.
How do you feel as a reporter, John Upton, about the safety? I mean, listeners wondering just how safe are they going to be? How much are these NTSB recommendations going to be followed and adhered to and make for changes that are substantive?
Well, the NTSB has a very strong record of getting to the bottom of what caused disasters. I am sure that, I mean, I am confident that they will come out, and they already have come out with some solid recommendations, and I would expect the state of California through the CPUC to ensure that those recommendations are adhered to. I think what this really points out, I think that this tragedy really highlights, you know, just it's another sign of our dependence upon fossil fuels, our addiction to cheap energy, and I think that it should start raising some questions about whether we should be paying more for natural gas in order to fund the safety measures. And once that natural gas price starts rising, it starts making wind and solar look a lot more attractive financially.
Let me go to some emails here. And by the way, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by phone at 866-733-6786, or simply post something on our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Here's Craig, who says, the issue about the gas pipelines that everyone seems to be dancing around is the ancient age for a high-pressure line. Shouldn't high-pressure gas pipelines be regularly replaced when they reach a certain age, like 50 years or more, even if they seem to be in good shape? Because over 50 years old, you have a much higher chance of failures, especially at weld points. Richard Clark?
No, actually, the engineering science is essentially that as long as pipelines are coated and cathodically protected, they're not going to return from their state of steel into their original state of iron, which is what you're trying to protect them from with the coating and the...
So they can theoretically last hundreds of years.
That's correct.
There's another listener, Karen from Oakland, who says, the gentleman from the PUC says that PG&E's records of problems is high because PG&E self-reports, as if this were something they should get credit for. PG&E self-reports because they know that the PUC is a toothless paper tiger, which will accept their problem reports and never, ever require them to do anything about them. It was the PUC's responsibility to regulate how PG&E manages their gas lines, and they totally abdicated this in favor of staying on good terms with their golf chums at the company. Southern California Edison doesn't self-report, but over 80% of their network can be inspected with smart pigs versus something like 30% of PG&E's network. Richard Clark?
Well,
let's forget about the golf here, but, you know, to go to the substance of the comment.
Well, the bottom line is that, you know, we have issued in the 10 years that I've been with the PUC, we have done over $500 million in penalties and restitution orders to the various utilities around the state. I think it's $78 million of that is to PG&E for a transmission substation explosion that occurred in downtown San Francisco and some other issues. We're in the process of doing an enforcement action against PG&E for the Rancho Cordova incident where a distribution line failed. And we are, you know, I'm not in bed with PG&E, nobody at the CPUC who works for me or that I know of is in bed with PG&E by any stretch of the imagination. We have huge conflict of interest hurdles that we have to overcome.
Well, what about, John Upton, a phrase from this listener, Karen, about the PUC being a toothless paper tiger where PG&E is concerned? Can you comment on that?
Well, the CPUC certainly has been exposed to that criticism a lot recently from lawmakers and from the public. I think it's worth pointing out that only recently the CPUC, the five members of the CPUC commission, voted to allow PG&E to take an additional $29 million from ratepayers for renewable energy bonuses to which they were unquestionably not entitled. When you see the CPUC making these sorts of decisions, it does raise those sorts of questions about what sort of oversight they're providing.
And comment from you on that, Richard Clark?
I don't see the CPUC as being a toothless paper tiger by any stretch of the imagination.
What training, Charles a listener in San Francisco wants to know, is required to be an inspector. We just saw a fatal disaster characterized as urgent. Are other critical areas now being checked? Get into the whole question of training. What do we know on that score, John Upton, about the training necessary to be an inspector?
I know very little about that, I'm afraid.
Can you help us here, Richard Clark?
Certainly. Our people go through a training course put on by the Federal Department of Transportation. They're required to complete that course within 3 years after they begin it. It's a very detailed course. As I don't know if any of you have ever read 49 Code of Federal Regulations, Part 192, A through O, but it's extremely detailed. Extremely detailed.
I'll take that for a bedtime reading.
It'll help you.
We can go to more of your calls, and Joe joins us next. Joe, you're on.
Hello?
Yes, hi, you're on the air.
Okay, great. Yeah, I'm an engineer that works on energy systems. I'm not with PG&E. Just a couple of points. You're moving some pretty high-energy stuff around, and you're moving lots of it, and everybody expects the stuff to be there when they turn on their device. So I'm imagining if you could come up with an inspection scheme and a maintenance scheme that, you know, would take much more people than is possible to hire. So you do have to make some compromises. One more thing, I do a little flying of airplanes, which is sometimes involves you with the NTSB. And the NTSB comes up with recommendations for what's called federal air regulations. And there's an old saying that, you know, the FARs are written in blood, meaning, you know, who knew that somebody was going to do something or an airplane was going to do something till it happens. Then you write the rule. So you can't predict everything that's going to go wrong with a pipeline. Like it's 50 years old and it's, you know, in a certain type of soil, replace it. You know, till something goes wrong and you do the inspection and find what happened, there's going to be unknowns in the system. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. I hear from you on that, John Upton. Certainly there are unknowns in the system, as we discovered with San Bruno.
Of course, and there are compromises. This is life. You make compromises. You save money here, you save money there, you hope everything works out in the end, and pipeline safety, that's just the way it is.
Although certainly pipeline safety, well, at least according to NTSB, was not necessarily a priority as much as it should have been, and the records were not there in terms of the way they should have been.
I think that what happened in San Bruno demonstrates that that is the case.
Here's someone on our website, Leslie, who writes, why has the CPUC failed to find PG&E or even open a formal investigation into the Rancho Cordova explosion? Actually, Richard Clark mentioned that there is a formal investigation now that killed a customer in his home and injured three others 2 years ago. At that time, federal investigators blamed PG&E for failing to act on previous safety warnings, but it isn't clear whether their recommendations for changes to PG&E's gas safety practices were ever enforced.
Oh, they've absolutely been enforced. We take the NTSB recommendations very seriously.
And another listener, Elizabeth, writes, I understood the current guest to say something to the effect that California did not have enough field engineers to require utility companies other than PG&E to self-report safety problems. I don't understand the statement. Wouldn't a self-reporting requirement actually reduce workloads by putting the burden on the utility companies to self-monitor and report?
Well, the self-reporting is only a portion of the inspection regimen. Again, we have them go out and do, and this is the integrity management program. It's just one facet of what we do. I mean, and so we regulate not only PG&E, Southern California Gas, San Diego Gas and Electric. We've got 2,600 mobile home parks, all these propane systems in the state of California also that we regulate in terms of natural gas safety. Our job is to ensure that the utilities, who are the ones responsible for the safety of their organizations, are doing what they need to do in order to make those, to maximize the safety of those systems. We look over their shoulders, and we ensure that they're finding what they should be finding, and they're doing what they should be doing when they find the things that they find. And so we do a lot of records reviews. We do spot checks and spot audits. The more inspectors we have, the more spot checks and spot audits that we can do. and the more enforcement actions that we can undertake.
Do you have enough personnel, enough inspectors with all that, all those mobile homes and all that propane and all that you have to cover?
I think it's clear we don't.
Yeah, I would think so. Richard Clark, again, is Director of Consumer Protection and Safety with the California Public Utilities Commission. What are you going to do about that? I mean, about getting more inspectors, especially with this revenue situation that we have in this state. Or what can you do?
Well, we'll go through the process. We'll be having discussions with the Department of Finance and the governor's office and that sort of thing, and seeing what it is that we can do in terms of increasing the staff to the levels that, that we'll need.
How much do you see that short staff as a problem, John Upton?
Well, it's been it clearly is a problem, and it's been expressed as such by the CPUC, who employs those inspectors. And it's unusual and it's surprising to me that it's taken this tragedy for CPUC to ask for the additional money for the additional inspectors.
We asked for these inspectors before the tragedy occurred.
We'll go to more of your phone calls. We go next to Penn Grove. Richard, join us. You're on the air.
Thanks, Michael. Thank you for the program. Gentlemen, I just wonder, under past administrations, both local and national, what was the number, the maximum number of inspectors at any one time in the past, and what has led to the fact you only have nine, I think you said?
Richard Clark.
The recommendation from PHMSA, the Federal Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration, is that we were to have 11. And we've now surpassed that. We're at 13 now.
Let me thank the caller. And again, Richard Clark is Director of Consumer Protection and Safety with the California Public Utilities Commission. Keith from Alameda says you didn't really get answers to two callers' questions. Does PG&E know where all its pipelines are, and do they know how much gas is leaking? Richard Clark?
They certainly know where all their pipelines are.
I would presume and hope, yeah.
And they certainly know how much gas they're paying for when it comes into their system and how much they're charging for when it goes out of their system, and they have very regimens for testing that are specified in federal and state law, where they have to do leak detection along these lines on a consistent basis and quite frequently. So basically they know where the leaks are. What they don't know here in this particular situation was that they had a piece of pipe that they believed to be a seamless piece of pipe in the ground, where it's hard to detect, and it wasn't a seamless piece of pipe.
Again, we get back to the documents, John Upton. Are these documents just, are they antiquated? Are they messed up? Are they pre-computer? I mean, obviously many of them are. We've got pipelines that are 54 years old, but how much of it is bureaucracy?
Well, the sense that I get is that it's sloppy record keeping. That's the sense that I get. I could be incorrect, but that's certainly the perception that I have. Simply not knowing where the original paperwork was, just basic filing, basic stuff like that, you know.
We'll go to more of your calls, and we go next to Lee. Thanks for waiting. You're on with us. Good morning.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. Just wondering why we don't have some type of a plan that changes these pipes after every 40 or 50 years. Why does it take a disaster in order to get everyone talking about this and thinking about this? Isn't there some type of a check and balance in the whole system? Seems like that in a lot of our state and city projects. It just seems like it's a disaster to get people to start making changes.
Yeah, what are the checks and balances as you see it, John Upton? And John Upton, again, has been a reporter following this whole story for the Bay Citizen.
Well, the checks and balances start and stop with the CPUC, basically. I would ask Richard to comment on that one.
And who checks up on the CPUC, Richard?
Actually, they don't start and stop with us. They start and stop with Pacific Gas and Electric, Southern California Gas, and San Diego Gas and Electric. They're the ones who are responsible for the safety of their systems. We're responsible to make sure that they're doing the best that they can. The inspection regimen, I mean, this is not something that's just driven by these sorts of fatalities, these sorts of events, catastrophic events. This is something that people work on all the time. There are gas leak detections, surveys that are done on a consistent basis. The inspections for both internal and external corrosion take place on a continuing basis. These systems are monitored continuously. There are thousands of people around the nation who work on the safety of the gas system on a daily basis and take their work very, very seriously. And it's just incorrect that these sorts of that the inspection or the maintenance of the system is driven by these catastrophic events. What occurs is that the catastrophic events cause quantum leaps in the ability to have better detection equipment, corrosion detection equipment, the smart pigs and that sort of thing. I think you're going to see some big improvements in smart pig technology, regulatory oversight, the cost. People then begin to reevaluate what the true cost of safety is in these sorts of high-consequence systems. And so that's what really gets changed, is that kind of quantum leap. It's not the ongoing efforts of very concerned and very dedicated individuals to keep these systems safe.
You spoke before about the fact that the age of the pipelines really is not all that relevant. Listener Sue writes, if San Bruno lines are 50 years old, how much older must San Francisco lines be, and how would you characterize the gas pipeline safety in San Francisco? They are older, of course, in many instances, but just in general, the safety of San Francisco's pipelines?
I think that the gas transmission pipelines and distribution systems are safe, and we're continually improving the process by which we evaluate the safety and inspect and attempt to maintain the safety of those systems.
You feel the same way, John Upton?
I think that what's important is that we start paying attention to where the pipelines are. There's very few municipalities in this nation that have planning codes that actually consider where the pipelines are. I think it's time for San Francisco, San Mateo, and other cities around the region to start taking a look at where the pipelines run and start rejecting applications to build homes and hospitals near those facilities.
On that note, we will come to the conclusion of this hour with thanks to both Richard Clark and John Upton, and thanks to Deborah Herzman and Kirk Johnson, who joined us earlier. And thanks to you, our listeners, will obviously continue to follow the recommendations of the National Transportation Safety Board and what they will bring into fruition. And as I said, California Public Utilities Commission has given PG&E until February 1st to comply with those federal recommendations. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. Another hour of Forum coming your way. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.